from WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend.
It's Weekend Update with Colin Jost and Michael Che.
Today, Michael Che and Colin Jost talk about anchoring Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update and preparing to host the Emmys Monday night. And we talk about feeding people in the aftermath of hurricanes. After Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, Chef Jose Andres and the groups he founded took over kitchens and schools, restaurants, and an arena, and organized chefs and volunteers preparing as many as 100,000 meals a day.
Every time you have a disaster, if you have to rebuild homes, you bring architects. If you need to take care of people in the hospitals, you bring doctors. If you have to feed people, it's only very normal and logical to me that you will bring cooks.
His organization is now feeding people in the Carolinas. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are Colin Jost and Michael Che, the anchors of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. They're also preparing to host the Emmys Monday night, and they're nominated along with SNL's other writers for Best Writing for a Variety Series. Last January, they became head writers of SNL. Jost had held that position once before, but gave it up after becoming an update anchor. SNL's new season begins September 29th. Let's start with a clip from one of last season's final episodes. Here's Jost and Che on May 5th.
This Stormy Daniels payment has turned out to be the loudest hush money in history. And during his Kings of Dementia comedy tour, Giuliani also said that the hush money was, quote, funneled through a law firm. Dude, funneled is not typically a word innocent people use when talking about money. No one says, yeah, my grandma funneled me $5 in my birthday card.
Rudy Giuliani is claiming that President Trump only learned a week ago that he was reimbursing Michael Cohen's payment to Stormy Daniels in $35,000 installments. I have a couple questions. Like, what kind of billionaire pays for stuff in installments? You're the president of the United States. Why are you paying for sex like it's a Nordic track? And how did y'all land on $130,000? That's such an oddly specific number. I asked Stormy to come on Update and explain it, but her agent said no, because if she's seen on camera with a black guy, her price goes down.
Colin Jost, Michael Che, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your writing nomination and on hosting. Before we get to other things I want to talk with you about regarding the Emmys and SNL, you know, I'm thinking as we record this Wednesday afternoon East Coast time, it's earlier than that on the West Coast where you are, there's a hurricane, like a catastrophic hurricane heading toward the Carolinas. And that's something that you might have to, assuming the hurricane is anything like what they're saying it will be, that's something you'll probably have to address at the Emmys. And, you know, it's really awkward to have a celebration when people are suffering like that. So is that something you're thinking through? Like, how are you going to deal with it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it crossed my mind yesterday. I mean, you never really know what's going to happen leading up to a big event because you're planning it for so long, and then something could dominate the news that day. But when it's something that's a tragedy, again, we don't know exactly what's going to happen yet, but the biggest thing I think sometimes we face it at SNL is you want to show as much support as you can, and you know, you want to use that moment to maybe just actually raise money for people who are there because you have a mouthpiece to tell people, go online, give money. The people in that room have money generally, and you know, you hope as you can make it a moment just even to get support for those people.
So the last time we spoke, Donald Trump was a presidential candidate. He wasn't the president. It was just like days before the election. So the first show after the election, Dave Chappelle hosted. Chris Rock made a guest appearance. A Tribe Called Quest were the music guests. These are all people with, like, strong political points of view. And instead of an opening sketch, the opening was Kate McKinnon dressed as Hillary at the piano singing Leonard Cohen's song Hallelujah. And she ended it by saying, "I'm not giving up, and neither should you." Can you take us behind the scenes a little bit and tell us what it was like after the president was elected, trying to figure out what the show, first show of post-election Trump era should be?
Well, the sort of like amazing move from Lauren was that he had offered him that date like at the end of that summer. So I think he just sensed that whatever was going to happen in the election was going to be this huge moment, and he wanted to make sure whoever the host was would be someone that could deal with that and who at that moment people in America wanted to hear from. And that's, I mean, Dave is basically the ideal person to do that. And then that night, you know, the election night was insane because I assumed, like most people probably, that Hillary was going to win, and you were watching the results come in, and, you know, people were having all kinds of reactions around the office. It was very intense. And you're then trying to write comedy, and, you know, not everyone even attempted to write comedy. Some people, understandably, were very upset. And Dave was the perfect host at that moment, because the next day when we were there for the table read, you know, he was just like, the reason you're in comedy is to react to things that are going on and to make them funny, to find humor even in whatever is the weird, darkest things. You have to figure out how to still put on a comedy show, because that's why you're doing this. And I think that was just the right kind of motivation for everyone to try to put a show together by Saturday that was still a comedy show. And, you know, I think that was reflected in his monologue really well.
So you all watched the election results at the office?
Yeah, I mean, we're there. Tuesday night is our writing night. So we're basically there all night. You're mostly there all night until the table read, which is Wednesday afternoon. You kind of go straight through. So normally it would have been a later start than normal because you're watching election results roll in. But then it was even more delayed because people were processing what was happening. I mean, it was very shocking. Whatever you expected going in, I think it was still shocking.
So getting back to Update, when you do Update on Saturday night, it's really Sunday morning on the East Coast, because by the time you're on, it's after midnight. Every late night comic has done bits on the week's news. And so, like, you're kind of like late to the game in that respect. So how do you find things that are going to feel fresh at the very, very end of the week or the very beginning of the new week?
Fortunately, there's not a lot of people that I think like me. So I never really have a problem with finding interesting takes, because I feel like when you kind of do your own thing, it's not going to bump. You know, if I have a thought and five other comedians have that same thought, then I feel like it's not even worth saying, you know.
What's an example of a joke that you can say that you feel like other comics can't? Can you think of one?
Nobody else is calling the president a cracker on national TV.
Yeah, that got you a lot of love.
Yeah, it sure did.
What kind of reaction were you expecting? Yeah, go ahead. No, I'm kind of being sarcastic. You got it from both sides for that.
Of course. Yeah. But that's, to me, that's interesting. That's compelling TV.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So
that week, too, I was just remembering, too, that week. I forget if we worked on it later in the week together, Jay, too. But the on election night, too, then we woke up after the next day, or, like, you know, in our office. But Neil Brennan was there, too, working on the show. He's a writer. He worked with Chappelle on Chappelle's show. But we wrote a sketch that was in the show that week that was about the election results coming in and people watching and sort of a time lapse of how the night went as the results came in. And we wrote that essentially in response to what was happening in real time in our office that night before, because, you know, the discussions were, you know, it was sort of like early joking around, like, uh-oh, Hillary didn't win Alabama. I bet, watch out. And then it got to like, wait, she's going to lose Michigan? It was like, it was that kind of thing. And it was perfect for Dave and Chris Rock, who came in and did it too later in the week, because they were not surprised. They were like, yeah, of course, this is how America's going to go. And they could play that attitude in the sketch, and it kind of reflected what we were all actually figuring out in real time that night. And I think when we read it at the table on Wednesday, which is the day after the election, obviously, when we read it at the table read, it didn't even necessarily play that hot because people were also kind of – it was very raw. So no one really wanted to relive what had just happened the night before in sketch form. But then by Saturday, I think people were ready to at least laugh about it, even if it was in a cathartic way. And I think they were. That was another one where like Dave and Chris were perfect for to come in and have that perspective.
It's very helpful to have a veteran or legendary comedian like Dave, where you kind of, you know, I think one of the things that years in comedy gets you is trust and people understand how honest you are. And I think it makes people more comfortable when they know that you're about to speak. And it's something that we all write toward, and hopefully someday we will create that kind of relationship with the audience. So coming from other comedians, it might have even been a really, really tough plane to land. But Dave being who he is and coming from him, it worked perfectly because I think people believed it. People said, yeah, I could see that there are black people and people of color that seen this happen and was probably like, yep, America's right on time with this one, you know? And I think that was kind of the tone that he was trying to, that was kind of the point. And it was kind of cool to watch because, not like I said, not a lot of shows can get away with that. And not a lot of comedians can get away with that. And so that's what makes our show special.
My guests are Colin Jost and Michael Che, anchors of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. They're also head writers on the show. They're hosting the Emmys Monday night. Here's a clip of Che on Update from last season's finale.
A report has found that 86% of people arrested in New York for marijuana possession are black or Latino. Well, duh, we're the only ones they search. That's like saying the only people that have STDs are the people that take tests for STDs. We're not the only ones that carry drugs. If cops search white dudes in cargo shorts as much as they search black dudes in hoodies, prison would look like a Dave Matthews concert. You know, people are always talking about needing diversity in Hollywood. You know what we really need diversity? Jail. Forget about Oscars so white. How about prisons is too black? Colin.
We'll hear a clip from Colin Jost on Update after a break, and I'll talk more with Jost and Che. And we'll hear from chef and relief worker Jose Andres, who'll tell us about his efforts organizing chefs and volunteers to prepare millions of meals for the people of Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. His organization is now set up in the Carolinas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Colin Jost and Michael Che, the anchors of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. They're preparing for the new season, which starts September 29th. They're also preparing to host the Emmys Monday night. They're nominated, along with SNL's other writers, for Best Writing for a Variety Series. Last January, they became head writers of SNL. Jost had held that position before, but gave it up after becoming an Update anchor. We just heard an excerpt of Che on Update. Here's Jost from last February after President Trump's first State of the Union address and Trump's tweets about it.
President Trump also tweeted that he had the highest ratings ever for a State of the Union address, which, get this, wasn't true. And this time even Fox News fact-checked on him. You know you're running your mouth too much when even your hype man is like, yo, that ain't exactly accurate, though. Thank you. Then in a new interview, President Trump stated that he is not a feminist. Was he getting accused of that a lot?
Michael Che, one of the things that you've said that's controversial is you were talking about Louis C.K. doing a set, you know, kind of testing out new material, showing up as a surprise to the audience. And there were a lot of complaints, like, the public isn't ready to see Louis C.K. yet. And you tweeted that, you know, he should be able... Well, it wasn't tweeted, it was on your Instagram. You said, a lot of what I read says that C.K. shouldn't get to be a famous comedian anymore because to them he's still winning. Isn't that strange? Meaning he can be shamed, humiliated, lose millions of dollars, lose all of his projects, lose the respect of a lot of his fans and peers and whatever else that comes with what he did. But since he can still do a comedy set for free at a 200-seat club a year later, it means he got off easy. That's how coveted fame is. After the response you got to that, the, you know, a lot of negative responses to that, how do you feel about what you said?
I think it was extremely ill-timed. The thing about when you write anything, you kind of surrender the context and you kind of surrender the way it will be presented to people and how people will, the tone it will take, you know? So I think you could cleverly make that to seem like a terrible thing and you can make it seem like what it was, which was just me saying, I just think it's interesting what the power of fame and what the power of stage, how it's perceived, you know? I just think it's extremely interesting. That was like something that was kind of selfishly a thing that came to my head immediately when I read those
stories. What do you mean selfishly? You mean because you're famous?
Well, selfishly because I work in this business and you realize that you're extremely lucky to. And it's a privilege, you know? It really is a privilege to be able to work. It's a privilege to be able to do this and have a job that you really, really care about, mm-hmm. and that people love and respect, and they will take it away from you, you know, whether you like, they will take it away from you, and they remind you, like, hey, you know, we will take this away from you, and I think that was what I was talking about. I wasn't really even talking about Louis necessarily. I was using him as an example because it was something that reminded me of, wow, this is kind of a special thing that we get to do. And he could go through whatever he went through, which seems scary as hell, deserved, and people will still say, well, you still get to do this thing, and that bothers me.
I think
them saying it, not me, obviously.
I think what's bothering a lot of women is that he doesn't seem to have done anything as of yet to change. He said he's going to spend a lot of time just like listening and thinking.
Yeah.
And if there's evidence that he's changed, he hasn't presented it yet. And I think that was what was bothering a lot of people. Like, he's back on stage, but like, what's different? What's changed?
None. You know what? And it's so crazy because I was just talking about this with somebody, but I don't disagree with any of that. Like, I truly think him going on stage and not addressing anything was insane, you know? And I don't fault the attempt of making it right. I do fault the execution of not making it right, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
Like, I think everybody has the right to defend themselves. Everybody has the right to take the opportunity to clarify or apologize or make any bad situation right. But when you don't do it, it's indefensible, you know? Like, what can you say? And I think that he missed a big opportunity to make that right.
So is this, Michael Che, is this one of the reasons why you're not on Twitter anymore? What we were talking about was Instagram, but still, is this?
I don't like Twitter because it's no one's as angry as they say they are. No one's as happy as they say they are. It's just kind of this land of hyperbole that I have a platform. Like, we go on TV and we're lucky enough to be able to tweet to a camera and speak. So it's not for me. I just don't like it. I don't like the way it makes people feel. I don't like the way it makes people gang up on other people, justly or not. It's just uncomfortable. I don't like it at all. It's just a cesspool of everybody just yelling at each other and anger and anger and like and I don't know what the opposite of anger is, but I've never experienced it. But anger and the opposite.
Peace, joy, yeah, I don't know.
Anger and extreme joy are the only voices that get heard on Twitter, you know.
So it was very controversial when Saturday Night Live had Donald Trump, candidate Trump, guest hosting the show, and you were doing Update back then.
Mm-hmm.
and there were protests and everything that you were having him on, mm-hmm. would you have President Trump on the show?
I mean, to me, I don't mind anybody being on the show because I think something good can come out of anything in comedy. But I wouldn't go for it. I mean, I don't know what the win is. I don't think people find him funny.
What was it like to work with him before he became president?
It was like working with any unfunny, insecure dude. You know, just like a, you know, that's another thing. Like when you see him as a human, and then he's in this kind of larger than life chair, it kind of, I don't know.
Michael, you said that when Trump was on the show during his candidacy, that he seemed insecure. What made him seem that way?
Well, most people are insecure when they come on our show just because it's a scary thing to do. You know, mm-hmm. it's very hard mm-hmm. to be on live TV. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to be around so much, a very talented cast that's used to it, and you kind of got to keep up with them, and the speed of the show is very intimidating. And I think it humanizes a lot of people. It humanizes most people that host the show. So, and also, you always think you're funny until you're in front of an audience, you know, especially an audience that's not necessarily your audience.
But did he do particular things that made him seem insecure?
There's always a code of, we know how hard the job is, so, you know, it's almost doctor-patient privilege when you host
sure.
a show.
It's HIPAA? Sure.
Yeah. it's kind of that, where we don't kind of, you know, spill everybody's tea, as the kids say.
I think it's interesting how comedy is changing in the sense that, like, there were so many comics for so many years, and maybe there still is, at comedy clubs, telling like sexist jokes about sex and about women. And I think, I hope that it's more difficult to do that now.
Well, I think being in comedy is kind of hard because like I'm exposed to so much comedy and mm-hmm, most mm-hmm. of the country and most of the world knows maybe 5 to 10 stand-up comedians. So, and they base all of stand-up, of the thousands of stand-up, they base everything based on, you know, who's popular at the time. And it's usually only 5 or 10 guys that are extremely popular and cross over mainstream. But as somebody that works in comedy, I think for years, and even studying comedy as a kid, like this is always going to be jokes that was funny 20 years ago that won't be acceptable years later. I mean, as a black person, you know, there's stuff that doesn't fly. You know what I mean? That would have, you know, mm-hmm. there used to be comedians that came out in blackface that was white, you know, like that's completely not acceptable anymore. And I think that's always going to be the case, especially now that media is so much bigger and more people have voices. They can say, look, even with the Louis situation, like, yeah, Louis can go out there, but also people have the right to come out and say, you know what, we don't want to see and we don't want to support anybody that supports him, and that's your right too. And I think that's something as a performer you have to deal with. People can reject you just the way you can comment on everybody, they can comment on you, and that's the way it is, you know. You kind of got to take what you get from that.
So, and there's two elements to anything like that. Is one is it how does it fly among your peers? You know, if someone's a comedian and they're doing jokes like that now, it's not even your peers. Your peers would probably just be like, why? Like, what? They might not even say that to you. They might just not really want to hang out with you or really think that was a great, whatever. You know, that's part of it. And then the other is just audience.
So I think I need to let you go and get back to preparing for the Emmys. Just a question. Are you nervous?
No.
I was going to say yes.
No, it's not. You can't be nervous. It's just, it's comedy. It's like literally comedy. Even if it's bad, that's pretty funny too. Worst case scenario, it's terrible and it's funny that it's so bad. So it's, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of. Nobody, like, this isn't a real job, man, you know?
That's a good.
If I was a fireman, I'd be. I mean, firemen should be afraid.
Very nervous.
Brain surgeons, but like for comedy, we're literally going out there and we're just going to tell some jokes and people are going to like them or not. But it's nothing to be afraid of.
Colin, you have firemen in your family.
Do you see it
that way too? That like fire is something to be afraid of. Doing comedy isn't worth getting really worried about because it's just comedy.
Certainly, fire is a lot scarier. Yeah, as the first basically non-hero in my family, I get nervous because I'm more nervous leading
because you
up
have
to
higher standards than Michael Che has.
Exactly.
I don't have high standards at all, man. This is back of the classroom humor. I'm throwing spitballs at everybody. I could care less. You know what's there to be afraid of?
I get nervous more when it's not in front of me. When I'm thinking about it in advance, that's more nerve-wracking than when you're actually out on stage and you're feeling, then you know what it's like to be on stage, and then that feels a lot more liberating. It's more the lead up to it where, I don't know, you having not actually gone through it before, where that's more nerve-wracking for me. But I would still take it over fires.
Good luck to both of you. Thank you so much for coming back on our show. I really enjoyed it. And
thank you for having us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good luck on Monday. Colin Jost and Michael Che are the anchors of SNL's Weekend Update and are head writers on the show. Monday night, they'll host the Emmys, which will be broadcast on NBC. My next guest, Jose Andres, is a celebrated chef with several restaurants who has also become a relief worker. After the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, he founded World Central Kitchen to help feed people in Haiti. The group's relief team is now set up to feed people in the Carolinas hit by Hurricane Florence. Andres' new memoir, We Fed an Island, is about the efforts he organized to feed people in Puerto Rico last year after Hurricane Maria. He took over kitchens and schools, restaurants, and an arena, and organized chefs and thousands of volunteers to prepare sandwiches and hot food, as many as 100,000 meals a day. This year, Andres received the James Beard Humanitarian of the Year Award for his work in Puerto Rico and Haiti. In 2011, he received the James Beard Award for Outstanding Chef of the Year. In 2015, he received a National Humanities Medal from President Obama. Andres grew up in Spain and came to the U.S. after serving as a cook on a Spanish naval vessel. He became a U.S. citizen in 2013. Jose Andres, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on all the work you've been doing. You know, when I think of chefs, I think of like fine dining and restaurants for people who can afford higher prices for more subtly prepared food. Why did you originally think that chefs like yourself had a place in feeding hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of people after disasters?
Well, every time you have a disaster and you bring the different experts in the different areas for the reconstruction, for the relief process. So we need to understand that if you have to rebuild homes, you bring architects. If you need to take care of people in the hospitals, you bring more help with doctors. If you have to feed people, it's only very normal and logical to me that you will bring cooks. And that's what we do. Kitchens, restaurants are chaos. And chefs, restaurant people, we manage chaos very well. After a hurricane, it's a lot of chaos. And people go hungry. And people go thirsty. And what we are very good at is understanding the problem and adapting. And so a problem becomes an opportunity. That's why I think chefs, more and more, you're going to be seeing more of us in these situations. We're practical, we're efficient, and we can do it quicker, faster, and better than anybody.
Well, let's just talk about the food aspect of it for a moment. What kind of, say, in Puerto Rico, what kind of food were you able to supply that was different from what is typically given to people who are the victims of disasters?
Well, what happens at the very beginning is that everybody tells you, everything is chaos. There is no food. It's food nowhere. We need to start bringing food from other parts. We need to start sending ships. Well, let me tell you, there's plenty of food in Puerto Rico. The private sector makes sure of that. What we had to do is organize a logical system to start activating kitchens that will have generators, that will have refrigeration, that will have gas, that will have people to work preparing those foods. So we had to adapt. For example, sandwiches are important because you can make them quick, you can make many, you can use all the volunteers that want to help their fellow citizens. So what do? We bring bread from the mainland in a moment that the airport is in chaos and the ports are collapsed, or you identify the bread factories who are amazing and you help them with diesel and fuel to go back up. That's what we did. We partner with local bakeries to make sure that those bakeries will be functioning sooner rather than later. We began getting bread. We began getting every single ham and cheese we could get our hands on, mayo. We began making sandwiches day one. So what else we had? We had rice, yes. We had chicken, yes. Let's start making rice and chicken. This is something Puerto Ricans love. It's easy to transport, gets hot very quickly. You can transport for an hour and the food is going to arrive hot. This is the kinds of things chefs do. We adapt. So in Puerto Rico, we began getting our hands in anything we could get, and we began cooking.
My guest is chef and restaurateur Jose Andres. He's also a relief worker, and his new book is about his efforts in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. It's called We Fed an Island. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with chef and relief worker Jose Andres. His organization, World Central Kitchen, has a relief team that's responding to Hurricane Florence to help feed people in the Carolinas. This year at the James Beard Awards, the Oscars of the food world, he received the Humanitarian of the Year Award for his work in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, organizing chefs and volunteers, commandeering kitchens and trucks, preparing as many as 100,000 meals a day. His new book about that is titled We Fed an Island. He's also known for his many restaurants and for his creative food innovations. He grew up in Spain and came to the U.S. as a young man after serving in the Spanish Navy as a cook. So one of the things you needed to provide food for people who had none in Puerto Rico was to commandeer kitchens so that you had a place to prepare the food and cook the food. So how did you manage to find kitchens that had power supplies, too, so that you could actually prepare food?
Well, as we landed, obviously, you already make phone calls. And even the communication was almost impossible in San Juan and around Puerto Rico. I was able, through WhatsApp, to communicate with friends in the island. Jose Enrique had a restaurant right in Santurce, in the heart of San Juan. Jose Enrique is an amazing person, an amazing chef, and he made sure that he will have his generator up and functioning, gas to make sure that we could begin cooking, and we began getting tarps because his ceiling very much was leaking every corner, and we transformed his kitchen in our first relief kitchen. We went from 1,000 meals the first day to almost 10,000 meals a day only within a few days. But we saw that the operation was growing. So we had to move to a bigger one. That's why we were able to move to what they call El Choliseo, which is kind of an arena with a very big kitchen that we were able to secure. There we went from 5,000 meals the first day we moved in to 75,000 meals a day. But we knew that the problem was bigger because every day we were getting more requests as the word spread out around the island that the group of cooks was providing food. We began serving hospitals because the doctors and the nurses, nobody was feeding them. And these people were working 24/7 and they had no money and there was no either restaurants or supermarkets with food for them to eat. So we had to take care of people like doctors and nurses and others. But then we began getting phone calls from places 2, 3, 4 hours away from San Juan. So the plan was clear. The island is hungry. And with one restaurant alone, we have not enough. We did other restaurants around San Juan, other kitchens, but then we did a third one in Ponce, in the south of the island. And then we began getting this plan on a map with the help of the army engineers. What kitchens we have that are big and where we can convert into headquarters in different municipalities. And at the end, we were able to open more than 26 kitchens. And at one point, we had 18 kitchens functioning at the same time. One day, we reached almost over 150,000 meals a day.
You spend so much time trying to organize efforts, you know, getting like trucks and generators and restaurants and kitchens and figuring out what the food should be, that you probably were able to spend very little time actually cooking. But there is a picture on the cover of your new book, We Fed an Island, of you in front of this huge pot of some kind of stew, maybe, and you have a spatula the size of like a broom that you're stirring the pot with. What's in the pot?
On that one itself, probably we were making a chicken rice.
In like a tomato base?
All of the above, tomato and carrots and onion and different spices. And this was the rice paella operation. And this was led by an amazing man called Manolo, who was in Miami, a Puerto Rican and Spanish Puerto Rican, and came from Miami. And him alone made hundreds of thousands of paella, of rice and chicken. And yes, you're right. I was like going around the island, sometimes in helicopters, sometimes in little planes that we got donated or we rented, sometimes in Humvees. And the cooking I was doing was not much because I was an organizer. I was a leader. But sometimes, yes, I try to put my hands to show as a leader, to show that, you know, a leader cannot be in a room. A leader cannot be playing golf and tweeting about other things that they are not even a fraction of importance of 3 million Puerto Rican suffering. A leader is one that when something like this happens, leaves everything aside and goes to take care of their fellow citizens, of their fellow Americans. So yes, my team probably is joking on this photo saying, okay, the only time you would really cook and there they got you on the photo. Well, you know, I'm only as good as the people I had around me, and happens, it seems I became the leader, but actually we had 25,000 leaders. We had young girls, one girl called Lola, that while his mother and father were around the island on their food truck, giving food away in faraway, remote, forgotten neighborhoods, that young girl was staying behind in the headquarters, leading 1,000 people a unit of sandwich makers, making sure that everybody was working hard, working fast, and working efficient. Lola is 10 years old. We had leaders everywhere. If a 10-year-old can be leading hundreds of men and women in a moment of need making sandwiches, imagine what we should be expecting from our president or from the governor or from our fellow congressmen and senators. If a young girl was able to show leadership in a moment of disrepair, what should we expect from our elected leaders? If you want to lead, lead, but you need to be leading in the good moments, but especially in the moments of darkness.
So the death toll from Hurricane Maria was recently revised. It started off, like, the number that was released in December was 64. And it's just been revised. So the minimum now is considered to be just shy of 3,000. But a lot of people are saying, no, it's actually really more than that. You thought when you were in Puerto Rico during relief efforts that the numbers were really underestimated, in part because of the bodies you were seeing on the street, and that you knew the morgues were full. Can you describe what you were seeing that made you think these numbers are wrong, they're severely underestimating?
Well, what I describe in the book, as you see, more often than not, was just perception. But when you are in the middle of the fray, perception is good enough sometimes. And it doesn't make you an expert. And my role was not to be counting bodies. But I was all around the island. I was bringing food to hospitals. And it's funny because I grew up in a hospital because my mom and my dad were nurses. And they had different shifts. And sometimes the hospital was the meeting point. My dad will drop me and my mom will take me back. So I've been going to hospital sometimes for many, many years, almost daily. And I never saw a dead body. In my entire life, I think I've seen 3 dead bodies. All of a sudden, I'm here in a hospital, I'm here in another hospital, and here is one body, here is another body. All of a sudden, President Trump is saying 16 bodies. And by the time he said that, myself, without even looking, I saw 4. Plus, you were listening in stories through doctors and nurses of what really was going on. So only by that, without understand, we need to understand, it's not scientific, but only my perception, I was like, in my entire life, I only saw 3 bodies, and I've been in a hospital often, and here in few days, I see 4. I saw 25% of the death official toll that President Trump said. Obviously, this didn't happen that way. And by somehow keeping the real number away from the public, what this did was almost non-recognizing that the problem in Puerto Rico was huge, that the hurricane was amazingly big or bigger than anybody. If we knew that was 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 deaths, I'm sure the weight of the federal government to support the fellow citizens of Puerto Rico will be quicker, faster, and they will devote more infrastructure, money, and bodies to try to help Puerto Rico to be back. That's why it was so unfair. That was a disservice to Puerto Rico, and to this day is the reason why Puerto Rico didn't get help as quick and as effective as Puerto Rico needed.
You're a pretty famous chef. How did you start doing relief work?
Well, Robert Egger, he's been my mentor for more than 25 years and just helping feed the people in need in places like Washington, D.C. and other parts in America. That's been a big learning experience for me. But I think the turning point for me was in Haiti when I arrived to Port-au-Prince a few weeks after the earthquake. And I began cooking there in different refugee camps. And I created World Central Kitchen. I think that was the moment that I saw that we need, I do believe the NGOs of the future are going to have to be more specialized. And I think World Central Kitchen, we said that we specialize in bringing smart food solutions. And what happens is that once you are on the field somewhere and you know the landscape and you know how a city or an island works, when a tragedy like this happens, you become very good at resolving the problems. So that's how I began in beautiful Haiti. And I've never stopped. We don't go to everyone because I don't have always the time in my hands. But right now, I think World Central Kitchen, we are becoming first food responders. Obviously, you said we've been in California twice with fires for many weeks. We've been in the volcano in Hawaii. We've been in the volcano in Guatemala, almost 400,000 meals. We are in Indonesia right now. We are becoming a food relief organization, and I will love sometimes to say, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. This has been a crazy year. But you know what? I have an army of cooks, an army of chefs, that they want to help their fellow Americans in times of need. So, you know, John Steinbeck said it first, whatever there is a fight so hungry people may eat, we will be there. World Central Kitchen, hopefully in the years to come, we will be there in any emergency.
So my understanding is that you want to create an organization for chefs, for cooks, similar to Doctors Without Borders. So people are easily mobilized, chefs are easily mobilized in times of disaster, and they're ready to go and trained to do what needs to be done.
I think we are. I think, you know, one moment I wish I was active and help my fellow Americans was after Katrina. But I didn't. And I remember specifically about the Superdome. And you know what an arena is? Everybody thinks an arena is where an NBA team plays. No. No. It's a lie. An arena is a gigantic restaurant that happens, has NBA players for entertainment. So every arena potentially is a restaurant. It takes only few hours to activate feeding facilities in the arena in case of an emergency. I never forgot about that, and I've been thinking a lot about that. That's why now, when something like this happens, I try to get my hands in the local arena. In Puerto Rico, it happens. I got an arena. I got an arena to use as a kitchen, to use as a place to gather all the food that was being donated, all the food we were buying. And there we created a crazy dream. For a few weeks, I think it became one of the biggest restaurants in the world, 75,000 meals a day. We're going to have to start thinking with the mayors, with the governors, how in moments of tragedy, hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, how we need to be activating those arenas, those convention centers quicker and faster to make sure that we don't only take care of the people that are going to be taking refuge there for a few days, but also using them as headquarters to distribute food all across the different areas that they've been devastated by the earthquake or the hurricane.
You mentioned a couple of times in the book kind of breaking down in tears. Do you cry easily? Is that something that typically happens, or was this kind of unique to being in Puerto Rico and seeing the devastation?
I mean, you see me, I'm a big boy, and big boy, big bones. But, you know, I have a heart like everybody else. They train us, men, to be strong and to don't show who we are inside. But I think men, too, it's okay to cry. It's okay to cry in happiness, but it's okay to cry in the bad moments, and it's okay to show it to others that you care. And so, yeah, I get emotional, and Puerto Rico was a lot of emotional moments. I cry my first year, especially at night when nobody was around. I cry because I knew we could do better, and we were not doing better. I knew we could do better. But leadership was not there leading the amazing armies of the people they had to make sure electricity came faster, water came faster, and food was delivered on time, and medicines were being delivered on time. Many of those protocols broke, and we had hospitals with no medicines. And they had to come to people like us to ask us, can you help us bring this important medicine? And there we were calling Homeland and Washington and George Washington University and Harvard to say, hey, can you send us this medication that this doctor badly needs for transplants? And 3 days later, we were getting it in a private plane. Are you kidding me? If chefs like us, we can get impossible to get medicine. That's why I was crying, because I knew we could do better, and we didn't.
Jose Andres, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Jose Andres has a new book called We Fed an Island about his relief efforts feeding people in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. His organization, World Central Kitchen, is currently responding to Hurricane Florence.
Say it loud and there's music playing. Say it soft and it's almost like praying.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shirok, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.
San Sebastián, mi viejo San Juan, Isabela, Maricao.